I gotta be honest, I would kill a hobo if my Facebook page was filled with baby pictures. Ladies and gentlemen, boys and girls, welcome to the very first episode of Bad Voltage. This is a podcast in which three friends of mine, Mr. Brian Lunduke, Jeremy Garcia, and Stuart Langridge, we're going to talk about things that are interesting to us. Now, to be very clear, most of you will know us, well, certainly some of you will know us from open source and Linux and places like that, but this show isn't just about those topics. We will definitely cover a lot of that in Bad Voltage. But we also want to talk about interesting technologies in gaming. We want to talk about politics and music and things like that. So this show is about just things that are interesting. And it's a very interactive show. We want your feedback. We want your input about what we should talk about. So before we get started, let's first of all have a quick round of introductions. So I'll kick off, I guess. My name is John O'Bake and I work at Canonical as the Ubuntu Community Manager. I'm also really passionate about growing communities. So I wrote a book called The Art of Community and run a conference called the Community Leadership Summit. Really into heavy metal and barbecue as well. So, Brian Lunduke.
People
know you, right?
I guess so.
Who are you?
I'm a writer over at Network World and Linux World, where I was forced to read Jono's book. Let's see, what else? I did the Linux Action Show thing for a while, made some Linux software, talked about some stuff, got some people some mad. I don't even know what that means. Let's talk about Stu for a while. By the way, Stuart Langridge is going to be called Stu from now on by me. That's just how that's going to work.
Okay, so a couple of things before I get started. First of all, no, he isn't. No. Put a stop to that, Bri. More importantly, hi, I'm Stuart Langridge. I'm a web developer, consultant, raconteur, after-dinner speaker, generally marvelous guy. I'm in the UK. I've done a certain amount of this podcasting lark before, but this one should be a little bit more fun, I think. So I shall now hand over to the fourth member of the Quadrumvirate, Jeremy Garcia.
My name is Jeremy, and I am the founder of LinuxQuestions.org, which is now morphed into the Questions Network. I've done a little bit of podcasting, but not nearly as illustrious as these other three blokes that I'll be talking with. Ardent but realistic open source supporter and a ardent and realistic supporter of the miserable Buffalo Sports enterprise.
So I have a question for you in your questions network.
I have an answer for you.
Why are you so short? Why are you so short?
Ouch.
That was a good zinger there, Jono.
So anyway, enough of that. So,
absolutely. We are obliged to have at least one member who has to stand on a box to reach the microphone. But as we said, what we're going to be talking about on Bad Voltage is technology, the internet, politics, open source, music, things like that. So what are we talking about in this, our first show?
We're going to be talking about the Oculus Rift camera that sits on your face while you play some games. What else are we going to talk about? I don't remember. Jono, what are we going to talk about today?
We're going to talk about open source and free software social networking. This is, you know, there's been some attempts to create an equivalent to Facebook, an equivalent to Twitter, and it hasn't really worked out. So we're going to sit down and try and delve into why. Why hasn't it happened?
We're going to fix that right there.
And in every show, we're going to have an interview and a review. The interview in this show is with Stephen J. Vaughan Nichols, who's a extremely well-known, actually, journalist, technology journalist, primarily concerned with open source. And we've also got a review, Jeremy.
And that review is going to be Cards Against Humanity, a multiplayer party game, which is a little bit politically incorrect, reviewed by a man who is also a little bit politically incorrect.
So before we get on and kick the show off, also just want to make something very, very clear. So, you know, this is new for us. We've never done this before. As with, you know, we've all done podcasting before. It usually takes a few shows to kind of get into the flow of things. but we really need your feedback. Like, do you like the show? Do you think it's worth doing? You know, is it working? What ideas for segments? What ideas for topics would you like to see? You can email us at show@badvoltage.org. All emails are welcome, and we will have a letter segment on the show as well, which we'll talk more about later on, where we'll be reading out a bunch of your emails as well. So be sure to send us the feedback, and without further ado, why don't we make the magic happen?
Over the last few years, we've seen quite a few open source clones of popular social networking sites.
That's free software. Not open source.
We've seen free software, open source, whatever clones of popular social networking sites.
That's Libre. That's Libre.
So we had Diaspora, which is essentially a clone of Facebook and what became Google Plus. You had Identica, which was essentially an open source Twitter, and both of them attracted some interest, and they attracted primarily interest from the open source / free software / FOSS group of people. But they never really broke out into the mainstream. Why didn't they break out into the mainstream, do you think?
I have a theory here, which is social media. It really is. I mean, the tools are interesting, but it really is about the people, right? It's about the... I think the reason why they didn't break out much further was because the people who join some of these networks... I'll be honest with you. I haven't used Diaspora, which I know you love it when I pronounce it that way. but I've used Identica. And when I joined, it was a very, very... very, very passionate group of free software fans on there. And consequently, I think that, you know, when Facebook started out, there was a lot of technical people at the beginning, but then it started breaking out further and further and further because they added features that were of general interest to just general people, adding pictures and, you know, interest and things like that. And I get the impression that the reason why it hasn't broken out was a combination of the feature set as well as the fact that it was... This isn't just the people who are broadly familiar with technology. This is a group of people who are very, very, very focused on one small aspect of technology and also about how that technology should be used, like the licensing and the freedom.
Well, I think one of the things, especially when you talk about Facebook, even me personally, I don't really use Facebook. I don't really like Facebook, but I am on Facebook really for two reasons. One, because LQ has a fan page that has a fair number of followers that I do want to keep in contact with and connect with. But two, I really just want to...
How many?
Around 20,000, I think.
Nice.
Wow, nice.
And I want to see pictures of my niece. And my sister really is not a technology person, and that really is the only place she posts them. So I don't think Diaspora is ever going to reach that critical mass that I can see. And the other thing is their focus is privacy. And while I genuinely like privacy, and I think everyone on this group thinks privacy is important, the average person just doesn't care at all. So I think...
Right.
And it's unfortunate they really just don't care.
That's kind of the point. I mean, if you look at Diaspora and Identica... if you look at both those things...
It sounds
things,
like there, diarrhea there is, when you say it that way, man.
You keep thinking you're saying diastema.
You got to change.
If you look at those things...
Let's just change its name to colostomy.
Essentially... I'm ignoring you. It's Diaspora. Those things essentially set up to be clones of the service, at least initially clones of the service that they were working with, but with the difference that was important to open source people, to free software people, to people who value privacy above a lot of the other things. Now, that's good, but it means that if there's no reason to use those services other than the fact that they're open source, primarily the only people you'll get there will be open source people, which means that Identica as an example, you could get plenty of conversation about the Linux kernel, but not about anything else. And I think that's kind of self-limiting.
I mean,
Jono, when you said, it's kind of technology focused, one of the big complaints leveled against Google Plus is that it's only full of techies and real people aren't there. But from my point of view, that's not really a problem. When I want technical conversation, I can go to Google Plus and get it. That's great. But I very rarely want to spend my entire day talking about not just technology, but very specifically about the free software bit of technology. And not the technology itself, but the freedom part of it. I mean, I'm interested in that, and I want it to happen, but I don't want to talk about it all the time.
Even
and
amongst this group of people who are interested in those things, how many of you guys have used Diaspora regularly?
Not regularly.
Are you kidding? Hell no.
I have an account.
Yeah.
Well, okay, I think we all have an account signed up because you were interested, never used it. And that's us. Right. So if they can't get this group, any of us to have used it, they're pretty tough battle.
I think the distinction between Diaspora and Identica is that Identica managed to get enough people on board that there was a lot of stuff going on. Diaspora never even got over that hump. You go there and it would be empty. It was like a ghost town.
Well, I think Evan writes really good software too. So at a time when Twitter was down a lot, Identica wasn't. And I think that really helped it out.
Absolutely.
That's what originally got me over to Identica. And now Identica is, it's interesting because it's a very clear message. This is open source Twitter. They might as well have just called it open source Twitter and everyone would have liked it just as much. Diaspora, on the other hand, or Diaspora or Diosporin or whatever you want to call it, is a confusing, stupid little beast. And I say that with all love and respect. It has a, the people who built
it sounds
it
loving.
Very clear. A very clear and very good idea. But even with us, don't you guys find it a little bit confusing? Not in necessarily how it works, but like if you say, okay, find me on Diaspora, everyone's like, well, how? I mean, it's a much more difficult message. And then when you try and explain it to someone, you say, well, you know, it's kind of like Facebook, except there's a little bit on your computer and there's some over here. And then you go somewhere else and you just look around and Google for a while. And then eventually you'll have an account. It's just a very confusing thing. So it was never set up in a way to actually succeed. Whereas Identica just failed to achieve enough critical mass to make it big, which I don't think has anything to do with open source. There's a billion social networks out there from Plurk and everything else that have never went anywhere, that didn't make it even half as far as what Identica did. So I don't think open source really enters into it so much. I think it's more of a question of there's just so many social networks that 99% of them fail.
Well, the thing as well is, I mean, of course, it's difficult to judge these tools because it really depends on the people you're connected to. So, for example, you know, Ak, you mentioned earlier on about Google Plus. I find Google Plus really, really cool. I find it the most useful out of all of them because I'm connected to a really good group of people who post really interesting things. But I've talked to other people about Google Plus and they're like, well, there's just nothing interesting there for me because they're not connected to people who are interesting to them or their friends are not on there. And for me, the same thing happened with Identica. There was some people on there who were interesting, but it got to a point where all I ever saw on Identica was Flame Wars. And it got to a point for me where I thought, well, why would I? I'm just not interested in reading this stuff, you know. Just not interested in posting something and then getting shouted at. And not everybody, of course, was like that. But it became a little bit. I found that Identica for a while became a little bit self-righteous, and that became off-putting to me. In the same way that Facebook for me has become more off-putting because a bunch of the people who I'm connected to on Facebook, all I ever see is pictures of babies, and that's cool for those people. I'm happy for them, but you know, it's just not that interesting to me to see constant pictures of babies and a mixture of baby pictures and atheist rants.
I gotta be honest, I would kill a hobo if my Facebook page was filled with baby pictures. All I get are political rants of people on every spectrum who have absolutely no idea what they're politically ranting about and posting like little picture infographics with just 99 false facts.
Those are the worst.
And just angry about it. And so I can't handle it. So I move over to Google Plus and I see awesome Doctor Who pictures. It's such a better experience for me.
To be honest with you, I think the thing which came alongside this and which has taken over my reading of individual things. So if I want to read about software, I want to read about Ubuntu or whatever, I do it all on Reddit now. And Reddit has the advantage that you've got the separate individually focused things. So there are people who are only talking about one particular subject, but Reddit as a whole has grown and grown and grown. And they've grown hugely. I mean, they've gone from being a tiny little site where people would sit and discuss software to having Barack Obama show up and do an AMA, for goodness sake.
Yeah, how great is that?
And importantly, dickheads get downvoted. Like if you look at Ask Reddit as an example, there's like when you look at the comment thread, it's really, really friendly, nice comments because dickheads get downvoted.
I assume the Reddit software itself is not itself open source. So presumably someone somewhere has made a Reddit copy which is on GitHub or whatever, which someone could run
it,
and is trying to persuade people to use it instead of Reddit. But I haven't even heard of that.
What's amazing about Reddit as well, just going off topic a bit, is that it's run by like 9 people.
Yeah.
It's like 9 people out of the
Their staff is really, really small.
But they're just... A guy came to a LUG meeting one time, and I met him, and it's just cool what they're doing. So it sounds like, you know, the overall view here is the reason why they haven't really succeeded is not because of open source. It's a mixture of features, it's a mixture of people, that kind of thing. Would you guys agree?
I'd agree. I think one thing that Identica specifically, because it was open source, even though Identica didn't necessarily succeed, it has evolved through StatusNet and some of the Pump.io stuff that he's doing now into a genuinely useful, interesting project, where if it wasn't open source, that wouldn't have been the case. But I do agree with the overall consensus.
If you're prepared to declare we built a thing where people want to go and talk about software, if you define that as success, then they have absolutely succeeded at Identica. Diaspora, not so much.
And I think they had unrealistic kind of expectations from the beginning. I think, you know, the timing of their launch with what Facebook was doing around privacy at the time really led to people being interested in that topic for a very short time and then realized it wasn't, you know, going to happen. First bad voltage review, we have the mildly politically incorrect John O'Bacon reviewing the mildly politically incorrect Creative Commons licensed multiplayer party game called Cards Against Humanity.
Cards Against Humanity has been taking the world by storm. In an age of sprawling, super realistic video games, high-octane blockbuster movies, sold-out festivals, and other vivid entertainment options, you'd imagine that a card game would be relegated to the domain of those who wear beige trousers, eat boiled sweets, and fart without realizing. But Cards Against Humanity is different. This isn't your grandmother's game of bridge, oh no. This game has got 2 midgets shitting in a bucket included. Today I'm going to review 2 aspects of Cards Against Humanity. Firstly, I'll review the game and judge whether it's actually worth bothering playing in the first place. And secondly, I'm going to review the box set of cards that you can buy to get you started. The game is simple. In it, you have a collection of black cards and a collection of white cards. Each player is given 10 white cards. These cards include a range of terms from the innocent, such as apologizing and Neil Patrick Harris, to the weird, such as a plunger to the face and Oprah Winfrey sobbing into a lean cuisine, to the blatantly looking to offend such as nubile slave boys and poorly timed Holocaust jokes. A player begins as the dealer and deals a black card. These cards have either a question such as what's that smell, or a sentence with blanks such as when all else fails I can always masturbate to blank, or dear sir or madam, we regret to inform you that the office of blank has denied your request for blank. Now each player then uses their collection of filthy and firthy white cards to either answer the question or fill in the blanks. The dealer then reads out the black card in full, replacing the blanks or answering the question with each player's entry. When the full collection of disturbing sentences has been uttered by the dealer, he or she picks what they think is the funniest entry. The winner gets the black card and becomes the dealer. The most number of black cards at the end of the game wins. So the game is simple and laden with potentially amusing concoctions of black and white cards. But is it any fun? Now, let me put it this way. The first time I played Cards Against Humanity, I think I peed a little bit. You know, just a drop, not too much to be weird, but enough triggered by the deep, reaching belly laughs forcefully shared with my friends with my velvety baritone. You see, Cards Against Humanity, a game whose strapline is party game for horrible people, is not just funny for the horrendous concoctions that people put together with their cards, but it is the performance and sharing of those concoctions that really adds to the comedy. Said comedy is further infused if the dealer is somewhat conservative or buttoned up, maybe a little bit of a traditionalist, a parent or a grandparent, or and I don't like to admit this, if they've got some kind of thick accent. It's not every day I get to hear my mother say, "What's that smell? Two midgets shitting in a bucket." It's also rare to feel the sense of pride to see my very same mother gleefully thrust her hand into the air to claim her victory of a round with the sentence, "And the Academy Award for me time goes to a sad hand job." The core concept of the game has a few other sneaky advantages too. Firstly, the game is simple. Cards Against Humanity goes hand in hand with your favorite alcoholic beverage. And under such testing drinking conditions, you don't want to have to memorize 1,000 carefully worded rules. Likewise, it's simple to dip in and out of the game to go and unload the 9 pints of Newcastle Brown Ale that you've been holding back to wait to hear your boss say, "Lance Armstrong's missing testicle." There's also some strategy involved in this game. The more you play it, the more you'll learn about what certain people find funny. Some may find outrageous and disgusting cards funny, but some may prefer the more subtle and drier statements. Likewise, in most rounds, you'll have a collection of not that funny cards, so you'll often have to figure out a way of dumping them to get better cards without wasting a round. As such, the game adds a little bit of a challenge. What's also neat about Cards Against Humanity is that the entire game was funded with the crowdfunding website Kickstarter, and the full game is available for free from cardsagainsthumanity.com. The game is also available under a Creative Commons license, and the creators have even gone so far as to explain how to print your own set of cards, and they include a downloadable PDF file so you can print out the cards at somewhere such as Staples, costing around $10. This makes the game accessible to everyone. This is a remarkably nice touch from the creators. The Cards Against Humanity team, though, do make available some pre-made sets of cards, and I felt a certain ethical responsibility to pay for a proper set to compensate them for a game that's provided me with hours and hours of incredible pleasure and delight. As such, I bought the main set for about $25, and the expansion sets, 1 and 2, for about $10 each respectively, all from Amazon.com. The sets come in simple but well-designed boxes, with the main set including 550 cards. That's 460 white cards and 90 black cards. The cards are made out of high-quality cardstock with rounded corners. The print is clear, and it also includes a set of instructions too. The cards fit neatly into the box, but they're not too snug so you can't get them out with itchy fingers. The box is tough and durable and should provide years of horrible fun. Now, for $25, this felt like a pretty reasonable deal to me. Sure, it's just a bunch of cards, but the quality of the cards, the large number of cards provided, and the fact that they give the game away for free online kind of made me feel like my $25 included a tip to the creators too. The expansion sets simply include more cards. There's 100 cards in each set, that's 80 white cards and 20 black cards, and the quality of the cards is the same as the main set, although the box feels a little less durable. While the extra cards add more amusing options to the games, it does feel like they could have squeezed a little more than 100 cards in for $10, so it didn't feel like quite the best deal to me. So, with all of that in mind, what is the Bad Voltage verdict? Cards Against Humanity is a hugely enjoyable and inherently social game for like-minded people. It's simple, fun to play, and the box sets of cards are high quality and durable. If you like laughing at things that you shouldn't, just like I do, Cards Against Humanity is a must-play game.
Well, I mean, the thing I was when Jono mentions playing it with his family, I was present during that game, and having only met his mother, only a few hours previously, it was quite a surprise to see this quite nice, friendly, older English woman trot out a few of the phrases on the cards. the game is, as long as you're among the right sort of crowd, the game's genuinely fun. I first came across it at a conference, tech conference, when Alan Pope, friend of the show,
Is he on commission? Because that's how I got into it.
Yeah,
well.
he brought out a set and a bunch of people sat around and started playing it. And it's got this massive advantage that you can have any number of people playing it. People can drop in and out of the game. So it's a perfect hallway game for conferences and things like that.
Yeah, yeah. Oh, what I love is when somebody who isn't familiar with the game and they walk and they start watching and they think it's like, you know, World of Warcraft or something, card version. And then they hear some of the shit that comes out of people's mouths.
I was going to say, I'm pretty sure that game, I've never heard of this game, but it sounds like it breaks the code of conduct of most conferences.
Most, yeah, by a fair bit. Yeah, I actually got introduced to this game. There's a tavern close to where I live called the AFK Tavern. It's kind of a place just for gamers and nerds and whatnot. And I was just there having a big giant burger one day, and the table next to us was just riotously laughing and saying just a huge number of completely inappropriate things. But what was really cool about this was they had printed up a couple hundred of their own cards that had Star Wars references, Firefly references. So you have things like Mal Reynolds, you know, buggering, you know, Vader and things like that. And it was absolutely fantastic. And it's just a totally fun game. And the fact that you can make your own cards and add to it super easily is just crazy nice.
I think that's one of the interesting things about it. The first thing everyone does when they play Cards Against Humanity is have a good time. The second thing is everyone sits around and says, man, we should make our own set of cards for this.
Right?
I was going to say, one of the things I didn't mention in the review was you actually get some blank cards included with the expansion sets. I'm not sure if it's with the main set where you can write your own cards as well. Not that you couldn't just, you know, get a piece of paper.
Right.
And write on it. The beauty of it is all the game is in the idea, which is why I like the fact that they did the whole Kickstarter funding and then Creative Commons thing. They've said, well, here's the idea. Go ahead, print your own cards, make your own set, make mobile apps of it, whatever. Not a problem. And as Jono says, you sort of think, well, if I really enjoy this game, I'm going to buy a set. And they make a bunch. It's almost the perfect platonic form of how people ought to make games.
Yeah.
Yeah,
I'm pretty
awesome.
Happy about the Creative Commons aspect. I am quite shocked that I'm the only one on this panel that has never played the game before.
Yeah, given your sense of humor, I am shocked too.
Yeah,
it's a pretty big deal around this area.
Jezza, you'd really like it. I think one of the interesting things about it is there's always been a kind of a board game, card game undercurrent in the techie world. There's always people at conferences who are sitting around playing Carcassonne or Settlers of Catan or Magic the Gathering or Munchkin or whatever. But none of those things have ever really broken out of the board game subculture. There's all people who use Board Game Geek and things like that. But Cards Against Humanity has the potential to be a kind of a breakout family game, assuming you've got the right kind of family. Right, so like Trivial Pursuit became, or something like that, things that where people will just have a set in their houses and start playing them. Now, to be clear, I enjoyed playing it with Jono's parents. I really don't think I'd want to play it with mine.
it's one of the things I've noticed, and I've only played it with really probably only two or three times with a bunch of people, and it's nice when people join the game because, you know, people who are a little bit more nervous in social situations.
Yeah.
And it forces people being into a situation where they make people laugh, right? They get the cards and everyone starts laughing because of the way they're reading it out. And, you know, and I think that's, you know, it's awesome to help. You can see people like loosening up when they play the game as well. It's not just that everyone's having fun, but I think it actually helps people to feel a bit more part of the group as well.
Absolutely. It's a great way of gluing a little group together, I think.
Yeah. So overall, I think it seems like all of us, with the exception of Jeremy, who hasn't played this yet, we all give it the thumbs up, and it sounds like Jeremy's interested in giving it a shot.
Oh, hell yeah.
So get out there, friends of the show, and check out Cards Against Humanity. And most importantly, send us an email to show@badvoltage.org and tell us the funniest, maybe some of the funniest hands that you've had in the game, and we can read some of them out. The video game world has been a world that has seen quite a lot of innovation over the years, right? We've obviously seen the original games consoles. We've seen the evolution of 3D, things like touch and gesture-based input on these games consoles and things like that. But fundamentally, the whole thing has always been the entire game world has always been outputted via a television, and you sit there in front of it and you play it. Something caught my eye recently called the Oculus Rift, which I think is really interesting. And basically what it is it's a virtual reality headset, you know, that you put on your head. And it's really, really immersive in how it immerses you into the world. Because effectively what I've read is that it's almost like an IMAX screen, but basically stuck to your head. So there's a real broad level of depth that you can see the game world in. You can't see the edge of the screen. This started out as a Kickstarter campaign. It got all of the interest from a bunch of the game studios. Steam are interested in it. The Unity folks are interested in it. And then John Carmack, who was the creator of Doom and Quake and those kinds of games, Wolfenstein at id Games, he's joined them as CTO. And I'm not much of a gamer, but I've been keeping an eye on this. And then I was at the Game Developers Conference. We were exhibiting Ubuntu there. And they were demonstrating the Oculus Rift there. I didn't get a chance to check it out because there was an enormous line. I mean, it looked like a line for a Disney ride. But it's just going from strength to strength. And VR was quite crap in the 90s. Many of you will have remembered this. So dear I guess my Lord, question yeah. is, I mean, do you remember that? I mean, you know, stood there with that
just
giant...
Just terrible. I've even got some of the old VR stuff. I mean, I've got, Nintendo's old... portable handheld that was VR. I've got the Sega 3D goggles over here. It was just all crap.
Yeah, it was just all nonsense, you know, and I've not really been kind of buying this whole 3D thing in video games and TVs and stuff like that. But this to me seems like a genuinely interesting way of rebooting gaming. So what do you guys think about that? I mean, do you think this is going to be successful? Do you think they're going to succeed in taking this out to the market and people writing games for it and people wanting to play games this way?
No.
I mean, they do already have a fair amount of early adopter success as it is. You've got a bunch of big names who are on board, not just John Carmack, who's CTO, but Gabe Newell's there, Yoshida, the Unity 3D team, the CEO has endorsed it, and so on and so forth.
Yeah.
There are games already either done or in development to natively support it. There are 100 or so games which work on it through third-party drivers, so they've got an active Reddit. So people are already using Oculus Rift and liking it. It's not like
I have to agree. I was really surprised with the number of games that already either committed support or actually do support it. But I agree with Brian. I don't think a mainstream consumer VR HMD is just a realistic opportunity.
I think Jeremy continues to make excellent points. I just want to point out that for those of you listening to this show, this is the first show we've released. We recorded a couple of test shows previously. Constantly, every 1 to 2 minutes, Jeremy had something smart and intelligent to say, which I just want to thank Jeremy for making that excellent observation. Here's the thing that I've got.
Thanks for that, Brian.
You're very welcome, smart man, Jeremy.
You guys need to get a room.
Oculus Rift is basically just a tiny little screen shoved into your eyeballs. And the problem with that is it really fucks with your ability to sleep. It screws with your brain chemistry. It does all sorts of stuff.
You don't have to sleep with it on.
No, well, I'm just saying,
just so you know, you don't have to. You don't just buy it and then they weld it to your head. You're allowed to take it off when you're not playing Left 4 Dead 5. Well,
so there have been quite a few studies done of like backlit screens on developing minds, on kids, on women more than men, where it really causes problems, where it causes depression and a lot of other things. And it's not just because they're just sitting around playing games, because if they were playing a board game or even playing a video game with a screen that was 10 feet away, they're going to feel a lot better. It's
kids,
not going to screw with their brain chemistry as much.
Amazing.
I just think it's a bad idea. Like, I don't see... I mean, don't get me wrong. I'm going to make a version of Linux Tycoon for the Oculus Rift just because. But all of that said, I don't see the point of it. I don't see what it gives us in terms of video gaming other than you can create a really cool demo where you're on a roller coaster and it feels cool, but you can already get that if you, say, go to a movie theater. You get kind of a similar experience.
But gaming is about immersion.
I don't see the point.
Gaming is about immersion, right?
Gaming is about having fun. Gaming is about having fun and getting excited and playing and having a great time. Right. Being immersed in a story or being immersed in a character is amazing. Feeling like you can't escape a world because there's 2 million blinking backlit LEDs shoved into the middle of your cornea is less immersion and more forced experience.
It's not forced experience. You chose to play it that way, right? Again, the thing is not better than life. You decided to go out and buy this and then put it on your head. It's a peripheral. To my mind, we're asking about, you know, mainstream acceptance and so on. To my mind, the audience for this is the same size and the same sort of people who go out and buy the steering wheel for their PlayStation 3 so they can play Gran Turismo 5.
Smart,
whatever, right?
Intelligent individuals.
Yeah, Jono, I've got the steering wheel bacon. Likes the idea of this. But it's that sort of thing. It's people who really want to get into the games who are doing it. And yeah, Brian, the whole immersive thing may not be important to some games. I mean, if you're playing Minesweeper, having it be a 3D wraparound universe is probably not that interesting. But if you're playing Spec Ops The Line or something, a game where there's a strong story and strong visuals and it's wholly designed to draw you in, at that point, having this immersive experience is clearly going to improve matters.
Switching gears a little bit as well, one of the things that I read that's interesting about the Oculus Rift is a lot of game studios, when they build these games, they take technical and design shortcuts based upon what the player is seeing and experiencing at any one time. And what's interesting about the Oculus Rift is because you can look anywhere, they can't take those shortcuts. So arguably what it makes is it makes more complete games. The thing that I think is going to potentially be a downside of this is that if I'm really that immersed in a game, if I can't see the edge of the screen, I feel like I'm there and I'm not getting horrendous headaches, I'm going to want to move. I'm going to want to walk around. And that is going to be weird because I'm going to be sat there. I'm going to be moving around in the game, but I'm not going to be moving around. I'm not going to be moving my legs. And I wonder at what point, you know, you can achieve a certain level of immersion and then something else limits you to the fact that you're actually sat in your living room.
Or you get up and you actually walk around in your living room and trip over the dog while you're trying to, you know, mortar shell the castle on the other side of the river. Right. So
do you think?
I'm not necessarily sure this is a thing.
I think, Johnny, you make an excellent point. It does force games to be more complete, which means it also forces games to be more expensive and take a lot longer to build.
And that's true. We're already in a situation where a game takes so long to design, to do all the art assets and so on and so forth, that games cost £60 when they come out. They take years and years and years to arrive. We don't want to make that
any worse.
Nukem 3
for Oculus Rift coming soon.
Exactly. Man, that is another really good point from Jeremy. This is getting ridiculous.
One of the other things, though, is people seem to think that this is the way forward. There's a thing on Kickstarter right now called CastAR, C-A-S-T-A-R, which is done by a couple of ex-Valve people. And it's been on for a week, and they're already 50% over their multi-hundred-thousand-dollar target. Right. And that's only a week in. You know, Sony have got a 3D viewer, which is due out in the next month or so. I mean, The Oculus development kit's $300. This CastAR thing's probably going to be about $250. Sony's is $2,000. So it's not quite going after the same market. But it does seem like people have this kind of nebulous feeling that full immersion 3D glasses are coming to gaming.
Yeah, I don't know. I mean, bringing this train into the station and looking around and seeing all the details, I personally think this is going to be really cool. Now, the caveat here, I've never used one. It may be bollocks when I actually put one on my head. It may give me...
And would you buy one is the question.
Right. I mean, you can buy a dev kit right now from the Oculus Rift website for $300. And so I think that, you know, the price is going to obviously probably be lower than that when they release this thing as a consumer thing, and it'll be smaller. But to me, that's within the amount of money that I'd be happy to pay for something if it's going to significantly enhance my gaming experience. But to pay that kind of money for something that you but to pay that kind of money for something that you like, to pay that kind of money for a game related thing is going to be of the interest, like Ak was saying, for people who play PlayStation 3 games and things like that. I don't think it's going to be casual gamers. This is going to be
by themselves,
the hardcore. Yeah.
Yeah, the big key is people who like to sit in a dark room with nobody in a 500-mile radius and play games, this won't be so bad as long as they don't mind their sleep getting screwed with. Seeing as this is the first episode of Bad Voltage, we thought it would be great to get a real hardcore interview going. And we thought to ourselves, what better way to kick off a show than to find someone, anyone really, named Steve? So what we did is we found the person with the coolest last name that we could that was named Steve. So Stephen Vaughn Nichols is joining us here today. Say hello to the entire world, Stephen.
Hello, entire world. You know, I wrote a program called with that one time.
Yeah.
Well, you mean some kind of rambling introduction to an interview segment?
Yes. Hello, world.
Nice.
So I think we should just get started with, for those people who don't know who Stephen Vaughn Nichols is, why don't you just give us a quick overview of who you are and what you do?
Oh, Lord, you don't know who I am? I am shocked. Shocked, I tell you. not really. My name is indeed Stephen Vaughn Nichols. Yes, that really is my last name. Yes, it's Welsh in descent. And what I do to keep a roof over my head is I am a technology journalist and have been for about going on 30 years now. And these days I write primarily for CBS ZDNet, since I have a face for radio and a voice for a keyboard.
And most interviews tend to ask all these kind of, you know, fairly fluffy questions, but this is Bad Voltage, right? We're about getting to the good stuff right away.
Certainly.
What has been, and you've been doing this for how many years now?
Going on 30.
Right. So you've 30 years of being a journalist. I mean, that's a tremendous amount of stories, tremendous amount of organizations that you'll have written about and worked with. What have you found to be the most challenging story that you've ever worked on, and why was that?
Wow, challenging story. There's a couple of ways I could take that. From a professional point of view that only journalists would care about, there are stories that I have not written, because they basically, would they have been big stories? Sure. But I'm not the kind of person that writes about what the CEO was doing with the wife or the husband of the CIO. And,
right.
You know, I mean, that may work really well in Silicon Valley, but I just as soon not do gossip stories, so I avoid them. And as far as technically hard to do, probably the worst was a piece that I did along with Ziff Davis Labs back in the, mid-90s, where we looked at every PC-based relational database management system on the face of the earth.
That sounds so much fun.
That was misery. We had to come up with our own benchmarks. We grabbed this data from a dry cleaning company, and we massaged and beat the heck out of this. Wasn't even a gigabyte, but in those days, it was still an enormous database. And so we had to massage the data. We had to then basically build the benchmarks, because we weren't happy with any of the database benchmarks that were out there then. That matter, I'm not happy with the database benchmarks that are out there now, but that's another story. And that was basically a team of five pretty savvy people who know their technology, and we just beat ourselves to death for about two or three solid weeks. No, it was very much like a run-up to a product launch, where it's just not going well. And it was just a combination of, you know, having to build a lot of this stuff on the fly, sheer massive data, entirely different approaches to databases. I mean, this was well before NoSQL and so on became an issue. But still, we were dealing with networks, flat tables, relational databases. Pure misery. I'm not sure that anyone would want to do this again.
This is coming through that it wasn't very much fun.
Man, I gotta say, your job sounds awesome.
I like my job. I really do. And I actually, my background is all liberal arts, but I turned out to be one of those people that I just get technology. And so for a long time, I was working as a programmer and then as a system and network administrator. And finally, I was sort of like, it's a technology problem. Throw Steven at it. He can fix anything. And along the way, I discovered that I was good at that. I'm not a great programmer. I'm not a wizard sysadmin, but I am pretty good at it. But what I was even better at is I could explain it in English to people who didn't have a clue. And I thought, I wonder if I could make a living at this. Here I am. And
that's a really valuable skill that a lot of people realize is so missing from technology as well.
Absolutely.
Well, that leads into an interesting question there. I mean, you must spend a fair amount of time reviewing and working with technology that you really don't think cuts the mustard, right? It's not really up to the challenge. How do you balance really wanting to stick the boot in versus your kind of ongoing reputation? There's kind of an ethical challenge there, I think.
Well, actually, I don't really see it as an ethical challenge. I mean, if something is truly miserable, but it's a small product, I'll just tell, which I don't do a lot of these days because I tend to work on bigger projects. But back in the day when, say, you know, a company with, say, 10 or 20 developers, they'd worked on a project and, you know, it was their pride and joy, but it just really wasn't good. I would tell them and I would tell my editor, you know, yes, I could review this, but really you don't want me to, because it just isn't as good as what's out there. Now when it comes to the bigger and wider world, like say the Microsofts of the world, I mean, I'm infamous for this because, you know, actually there are some Microsoft projects that really do work well. Server 2012 is actually quite good. Actually the entire server family since 2003 is pretty darn good stuff. But all too often, Microsoft just bows up, and I am never ashamed to say that they just really blow it sometimes.
Since
my audience is really the readers, it's not the companies. So, and I don't want the readers to go out there and buy a product that's bad. I don't want them to use a service out there that sucks. So I'm going to, you know, just tell them, you know, this just isn't good enough. This isn't what you want to use. Try this instead.
What relates to that is, you know, I know a lot of journalists have this delicate balance between writing honestly and not pissing off the advertisers as well. How does that impact your work? Do you have as much of that online? Because I know you predominantly write online, right?
Yeah, almost exclusively these days. You know, that's always a problem with journalism, but in any good company, there's going to be a wall between advertising and editorial. So, for example, I have no idea who we're advertising with, who our publishing and ad people are talking to about getting ads for CNET or CBS or ZDNet. I have no clue. And I beat up on companies on a regular basis, and some companies I say nice things about. I will also say sometimes good companies do bad or dumb things, and when they do, I say that as well. So it's, you know, for example, sometimes, you know, I am obviously very fond of Linux. I'm not fond of Linux because I like, you know, Linus a lot, or that, you know, I like Mark Shuttleworth a fair amount. I like Linux because it just works. But that said, there have been times where Linux companies have gone badly off course, and when that happens, I'll say that too.
And just kind of pulling this into the finish line a little bit, you've got 30 years of experience across a wide variety of different industries and different aspects that relate to technology. So what do you see as, what do you think is going to be the big thing in the next 3 years, say? Like, where do you, based on your experience, what do you see is going to be the key focus in the next 3 years or so?
It's going to be the end of the PC, you know. We see it coming. We know it's coming. I mean, it's the PC is never going to go away entirely. I mean, the mainframe never disappeared. It's still going to have a role 10, 20 years from now. So is the PC, particularly for people actually like me or anyone who's a developer. I mean, you need a real keyboard so you can get information down really quickly. That said, a lot of other people, though, don't need that. They want to be entertained. They just want to look up information. And for those people, a tablet or a smartphone or a Google Glass even, backed up by the cloud, which is where most of the data and a lot of the application logic is going to live, that will do just fine. And we're seeing it, but I don't think many businesses and a lot of people have really got it into their guts yet, that it really is just going to be a total transformation. In 3 years, yeah, everyone will have seen it.
Fantastic. Well, thank you so much, Stephen, for first of all being our very first guest on Bad Voltage.
My pleasure.
Secondly,
sitting through all of the technical issues that we faced today trying to get this going. And thirdly, for sharing your insight and your experience over the years. So thanks very much.
My pleasure.
Thanks, Stephen.
Thank you, Stephen.
You're welcome.
Which brings us to my favorite part of the show, the end. I want to thank Stephen Vaughn Nichols for joining us, who, by the way, is a wicked awesome dude. Thanks for joining us.
Absolutely.
If you guys have feedback for us, if you guys have questions for us, if you got notes for us, you can send those all into ilikethenamestew@badvoltage.org. Let's see what else we got. Anything else we need to tell these fine folks at home?
I think we should dwell on this for a second. Like, the feedback is really important to us. We really want this show to reflect what you folks want to listen to. You know, I mean, as we said right at the beginning, this is a show about topics that we think are interesting, but we're interested in a lot of things, and we're really interested in knowing what you're interested in as well. So, you know, send us feedback about the show, what you liked. Let us know your opinions about segments that we've had on today, ideas for reviews, ideas for interviews, things like that. We really, really want to hear your feedback. Send it over to what the hell did you say?
Show@badvoltage.org.
Show about, you can really send
it. Is that the real email address? I have no idea.
Show@badvoltage.org. Bear in mind that anything you send us, unless you explicitly tell us not to, may be read out on air as well.
Yeah, because
if you don't have any specific feedback or questions, we would still really appreciate it if you could send in dirty, nerdy haikus. That would be fantastic.
And I'd just like to point out, I think that things you don't like about the show are at least as important as things you do like. We don't just want positive feedback here. If there's something you think we could improve or we're doing wrong, do let us know.
Absolutely. I mean, to be clear, when you send us an email saying, I didn't like this about the show, we're going to read it. We're going to go, no, we don't agree with that guy.
Well, that's quite possible.
And then drop it in the bin. But absolutely, send us in stuff. One of the things that we want to do in our future shows, obviously we're doing for this, the first one, is to actually have a letters segment. So we'll read out your letter on the air. We'll respond to it. So if you've got questions for the four of us or things you want to see us talk about, send us an email. show@badvoltage.org.
And, you know, this is a new podcast. It's a brand new show, and you know, one of the ways in which we can get people listening to it, and one of the ways in which we can get people sending in suggestions and feedback about what works and what doesn't work, is if all of you who listen to this right now, our early adopters, the people at the beginning of the chasm, if you folks can share it on your social media networks, please use the hashtag Bad Voltage. Get out there, share it on Facebook, on Google+, and Twitter, wherever, on Diaspora, Identica, wherever else. And also, we also have the Bad Voltage Twitter account. We have the Google+ page and the Facebook page. You can find it all linked from badvoltage.org. Go and join those. We'll be posting updates about shows and things like that there as well. Did we get everything in?
Yeah, damn, that was sexy.
God, it's just...
Just to be clear, just so there's one of us, it's Diaspora.
the latest chapter on Stuart Ian Langridge is wrong about everything. So. All right, we'll be back in 2 weeks. Thank you for listening, and we'll see you soon.
Thanks for listening.
And goodbye.